Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of The Target Table. And on today's episode, we had Dylan Mullen. Dylan Mullen founded one of Australia's most successful e-commerce startups, Happy Skin Co. Launching in 2018, Dylan took on the billion-dollar hair removal industry, releasing his game-changing IPL handset. And in the first year, they turned over $12.5 million. Having worked from humble beginnings, he's one of the top e-commerce startups in Australia. Guys, I hope you enjoy and take away as much insight into the world of e-commerce today that I did, and let's dive in.
I went from having $1,000 in my bank account, living in Preston's, working, you know, in a corporate job, doing that to I'm fucking in New York City, standing like sitting this far away from Gary, drinking a wine, level 40, 50, whatever, looking around at the Manhattan skyline, thinking, holy shit. Life's crazy. Life's a game, man. You can make life whatever you want. I guess some of the biggest stuff I learned from Gary was about his whole content approach and his media team. Like, he has like 30 people just in Team Gary V. And then we realized like we had just, you know, grown for the sake of growth, you know, doing probably like $1 million plus a year in Europe and all these different countries, and like really figured out ads. We launched in April, so by November we figured out ads. And then throughout the whole next year, what was that, 2019, like, spend 10, 12, 15 grand a day on ads, like
a day.
A day.
Welcome to the pod. Thanks for jumping on, bro. I had fun on yours.
Yes.
Now you're here on mine.
Yes. And you, there were some dramas you doing Morgan's at our studio, getting sent all around Sydney.
That's okay.
That was hilarious, man. I felt bad, but I was like, dude, they were here. And then they got sent. They're like, no, come back here.
Yeah. We got the address wrong, or yeah, it was communicated. And we ended up driving across town and then
back again.
Yeah, having a conversation with some lady who was like, why are you here? And we're like, there's a podcast here. And she's like, they haven't been here in a year. And we're like, okay, we're at the wrong address.
Yeah.
But it's all good, man. We figured it out and we had fun. So, yeah.
Cool.
But thanks for joining me, man. I'm excited to dive in. And I know, you know, you've really done well in the e-commerce space. You've made tens of millions of dollars, you know, with Happy Skin Co. And you've got a unique product that, you know, took the market by storm using influencer marketing and doing a lot of UGC. But man, if you take us back to the beginning, I know you were previously studying law, then you got into acting.
Yes.
What happened there, man?
So the standard, like, I grew up in the suburbs of Southwest Sydney. I grew up in Preston's, which for anyone who doesn't know where Preston's is, it's 15 minutes from Liverpool. So not a lot of entrepreneurs that I knew come from there. I was a really ambitious kid, but coming through school, I was always, you know, top of my class or top three in my class. And when you're this kid, ambitious kid from the suburbs and you want to dream big, the biggest dream I could think of was being a lawyer.
Wow.
So that goes to show like, wow, like how limited, you know, my beliefs were based on who was around me, the education system. Like, oh, Dylan, you're really smart. Like, here's what you can do. You can be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. I'm like, well, I'm not good at maths, so it's got to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
So
what kind of law were you interested in?
Dude, I dropped out after like 3 months of uni, so I didn't get close to specializing. I was actually thinking of like M&A and like contract law and shit, which would have absolutely fried my brain. There's no way I could have done it. If I was going to do law, like, properly, I think what would have suited me most was probably criminal, but like, it's so much reading. Like, it's what they show you on Suits is not what being a lawyer is.
No.
That's like 1%.
Was that part of the inspiration?
No, this is, I think this is even before Suits. Like, again, I was an ambitious kid from the suburbs. I wanted to earn as much money as I could. I wanted to wear a suit every day, work in the city and argue with people. Like, that's how stupid it was. But again, that was me dreaming big. Remember, doctor, lawyer, engineer. That's where the money is. That's you dreaming big. So
what happened with that and then jumping into acting?
Yeah, so I went to uni. I was going down, again, the reasons I made these decisions were probably for the wrong reasons. But
you were young.
I got accepted. I got quite good trials results and I was doing quite good in school. So I had the opportunity to get early entry in a couple of unis. Mm. And my year advisor was like, oh, like Dylan, like I'm still good mates with him. He's like, again, explaining the pros and cons of all the unis, but Wollongong Uni, which was just like an hour drive, is like they have a lot of fun. They have really good parties and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, sweet, let me go down there.
Yeah.
So I chose that because of the lifestyle and like the parties and the atmosphere. But again, that was for people living on campus. I was driving up and down every day. So I went there and long story short, like I realized a lot more clearly than anyone had ever explained to me what being a lawyer is going to be like.
Mm.
And it was really, really boring for me. I was the type of person, again, I only found out I had ADHD this year.
Wow.
So this is like, again, I didn't get diagnosed early because I was quite good at school and stuff, but Yeah, so I got there and like I was doing the same thing I was doing in school. So I had only started an assessment the day before it was due. Mm. However, when you do that in high school, you know, you get home, you start at 4 o'clock, you finish by like 10, 11. You do that when you're in like a law degree at uni, you start at 4 o'clock, you finish at like 6 a.m. the next day. You drive down to uni with no sleep, try not to crash the car. Guess they get there, rinse and repeat. And I just got up to the end of the first semester exams and I really thought to myself, am I going to put myself through this? Like, I know I can cram and I know I can study really well. I've got a good memory and I know how to write. So that's what got me through school. Like I could write really well and structure arguments and sentences and paragraphs and essays, that sort of stuff. And I had a good memory. Well, like the way I would study would make sure like I remember everything. So, and I was just like, no, man, I was the first time ever in my life I really felt like, and this word wasn't even in my headspace yet, depression, like that. I feel like no one spoke about depression and mental illness like when we were
not
in,
really,
in high
man.
School like
or anxiety. It wasn't really so wait, how old are you?
I'm 30. I just turned 30.
Yeah, so I'm 33, so a little bit older than you, but like it wasn't really a topic of the day.
No,
it wasn't really common knowledge.
I feel like it was just after around the time I finished high school where there was like a lot of youth suicide started to happen.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was, I guess, in my circles, what started to drive that conversation. But I didn't know the word depressed. Like I didn't think I was depressed at the time, but reflecting, I was probably going down that path of becoming depressed because I was so unfulfilled. I was making myself do something that I really hated. And part of my ADHD brain, it's really good. There's pros and cons, but the pro is I can do anything I set my mind to. If I really want something, no one can stop me. Mm-hmm. But if I don't really want to do it, internally, there's nothing I can do to make myself do it. Like I am so shit if I don't want to do something. I just can't. Like it's so hard. So yeah, I was depressed. I dropped out. Originally, I was doing a business and law degree. I was going to go back. I was going to defer the rest of the year, take like whatever, 7-8 months off, just work, earn a bit of money, chill, and then go back and just do the business degree. That seemed like a lot better for me. But in that time, I'm like, I was lost, man. Like I'd wanted to be a lawyer for so long, like all of high school pretty much, had this such a clear vision and dream. And then I went there when within, honestly, 2 weeks in, I was like, oh, this ain't right.
Yeah.
And then a couple months later, I'm dropped out, very disillusioned, wasn't sure what to do. And I just realized like I hated that so much. If that's what it's like to follow the traditional path, I don't want any part of it. What can I do? What's a career path that is not about clout, is not about earning money, is not about what they tell you is the good or the right thing to do. I want to have fun. And I thought, I really needed at that point a dream, a big goal to excite me, to re-energize me, to give me clarity and purpose every day. So I'm just like, acting, why not? I didn't do any drama. I wasn't a drama kid in school. I never wanted to be an actor, never, never, never. But I thought, what's going to be just a fun life?
Yeah.
Let me just chase the fun for a bit. So I did some short courses. Was pretty good at that naturally. So then I had to do like an audition to get into full-time, like a full-time acting studio the next year, did that, got in. And then, yeah, five years as an actor was good. I learned a lot about human behavior, about psychology, about emotions.
So you went all in for 5 years?
5 years, yeah. So had the agent, done the auditions, filmed a bunch of stuff, like proper, like going in, crying 2 days a week, like complete, like emotional trauma in the best way possible. Like, it's a lot and it's intense. Like, I remember all my mates were at uni at the time and like they're in class, like actual in class hours was like 9 hours a week. Mine was like 20, 22 hours in class. And then for every hour in class is an hour prep. So it was like really intense. I learned a lot about, as I said, emotions, reading human behavior, adjusting. So it did serve me and I made a lot of good friends and it really fucking in a way saved my life. Like, I don't know where I would have went if I followed that path, but it really, again, for me. And then even when I left acting, the reason I left acting was because, again, I was really excited by the dream. I didn't stop loving acting or what that could give to my life. But again, I was going into these rooms, these auditions, and always having to ask for a job. I wanted to take more control. You do have a lot more control than I thought. Again, I was quite immature, I was 24 years old, but I wanted more control. So I thought, what's a better way to do that? Business, right? Mm. But before even business, there was a little period where I'm like, nah, fuck this. I'm going to go again. Back into the corporate world, I'm going to go into the sales because, again, I'm a people person. I like talking, I like communicating. I know you can earn a lot of money in sales. You don't have to go to uni. I'll climb the corporate ladder, blah, blah, blah. Tried that again pretty quickly and I'm like, yeah, no, this ain't for me either. But again, I met a guy at the first job I had. I was working for a media company where we used to like train like small businesses, like tradies, hairdressers, how to like market and sell a little bit better. Again, that was what we were selling, but really we were salespeople. But again, so then I met a guy who first person I ever saw had his own little e-com business, like ties, pocket squares, socks, men's accessories. And I thought, what's that? He came in with a box one day and he started selling it to people. I'm like, what's all this, man? Mm. And he's like, oh, this is my brand. I was like, you have a brand? He's like, oh yeah, I just, you know, got products from my line, send him my logo. I sell it from my website. I, you know, go to the markets on the weekends and sell it. And I thought, dude, how is that possible? Why has no one told me about this? So then I found out about e-commerce.
What year was this?
This would have been, so I started the business in 2018. This would have been, I'd say, early 2017.
Okay.
Early 2017.
There's a big wave of e-com around 2016, 2017.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Dropshipping became a big thing.
That's when it all started, right? And it took a little bit of time to hit my world, essentially. And then as soon as I found that, it's the same around the same time I found Gary Vee. Gary Vee was the first fucking person that got me into any sort of personal development. And I know he's not a personal development person, but he's the first person that changed the words and the perspectives going into my head that realized, no, you can work hard, you can create all this stuff, you don't have to follow the traditional path. He taught me so much about marketing and content and just hustling, and then it completely fucking changed.
His YouTube or his podcast? Or
YouTube, podcast, everything, man. I was spamming that every day. I was going from Preston's to Chatswood on a train every day. So I had like an hour 45 commute every day and just binging podcasts. A lot of it was Gary Vee back then. And then like I got into, you know, visualization and all that sort of stuff. My life really changed.
But this is all while you're still acting and partially working in the sales job?
I left acting when I got a proper full-time job.
Okay. So what was that job?
That job was, I worked for a media company, and essentially what customer facing, what we were doing was, you know, cold calling businesses, inviting them to an event to like learn how to brand themselves, market themselves more effectively, like really basic, like 101 stuff. But essentially what our job really was I worked for a media company. Essentially we're a sales team for hire. We work with some of the biggest media companies in the world, News Corp, Fairfax, and our job was to sell their unused ad space. So the stuff their reps couldn't sell, they brought us in to sell. So it was like newspaper, radio, pretty shit stuff that I also didn't believe in, which was another reason why it was hard. Right at the end of that role, they picked like the top three people to move into like their Facebook team and start, you know, essentially teaching people how to use Facebook and that. So that was a lot more, you know, in alignment with my values. But at that point I was already checking out, knowing I was gonna leave. Yeah.
So you were fully invested into Gary Vee, digesting that content and getting into like visualization you read The Secret and that really shifted a paradigm for you, and then you started to, I guess, adjust your frequency or your thought patterns. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about it was I didn't really need to adjust much. It was more realization that everything that I had done in life, as I said, like I was quite good in school. I would top all the exams, like pretty much. And I remember like I was a little bit of a cocky kid in school, friendly cocky, not like an arrogant dickhead, but like I'd be walking around like, oh, you know, I'm going to come first in this exam, right? Yeah. Like it's all good. Like everyone would be like, oh, shout out. No, I'm going to beat you. And then they rarely ever did. But like, it was because I'm convinced all the things that happened to me, even girls.
Yeah.
Like I would always overperform in girls to how I look. I was like a redhead, freckles kid. Like, and I always did pretty well with girls.
I don't know, man. Some girls like redheads, you know?
Yeah, well, now, and back then it was definitely
it's
not.
It's like cool now.
Yeah, it's exactly. Red hair and ADHD are cool. All
girls
of a sudden,
now like, apparently. I learned to be a redhead. People like, damn, how'd you do it?
But it definitely wasn't the cool thing back in school. And I feel like, I don't know how, like most redheads that I knew were bullied or they weren't the cool kids. Like somehow I just managed to navigate all that without really copying any bullying, you know, little, you know, comments here and there. Like everyone picks on everyone in school, but like I avoided the bullying phase really well considering, you know, where my starting point was.
Do you think that was because of confidence?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of confidence, right? So I had to build my confidence pretty quickly, but also this is going back to like childhood, like as you would know, like a lot of your internal, you know, self-love, self-worth values come from your childhood and how much you were loved and cared for and told you could. So that foundation was built by my parents and my grandparents when I was really young. But then getting into school, being quite good at sport and quite good academically allowed me to build the next layer on top of that. So that helped me a lot. Yeah, I can't remember what your question was now.
That's okay. And then, you know, so you were listening to Gary Vee and you started to see, you know, this guy selling e-commerce products and you became obsessed with it, you became interested in it. Like, yes. How did you go from seeing that to going, you know what, I'm going to start my own online business?
Yeah. So it was a little bit of a process. I didn't start it straight away, but he was the first person that made me realize I could start my own business. It was this time, very pivotal time in my life where...
You were listening to Gary Vee at this time as well?
Listening to Gary Vee, started reading so many personal development books. And just like, that was the first time that like I understood and found out again, like, again, I'm this kid from the suburbs. I'm sure, you know, people from the beaches or the east, maybe their parents tell them about my parents were great, but they weren't. Well, I didn't live with my dad. My dad was quite successful. My mom was incredibly giving, warm, loving, supportive, but doesn't have an ambitious bone in her body. Mm. So all of this came from me internally. Right. So I wasn't taught any of that. So once I come across like personal development and reading all these books and what they can do for your life, and once you start improving and bettering yourself in each area, it becomes the most addictive process ever. Like, I want to become the best person I can. That doesn't just mean in one area of life, that means it all. So yeah, I got really into personal development books. I went to heaps of business events, seminars, and just like surrounding myself with this whole other world of people trying to build something for themselves, listening to podcasts with people talking in ways that I've never heard people talk before, seeing people start businesses, it changed everything for me. And one thing as well, and this is like for a lot of people that are like myself, like they'll have this big grand vision for their life, but it doesn't mean you need to exactly know how you're going to get there. Mm. You just need to put in the work every day. And like, that's the thing, like lawyer, acting, corporate sales and business, it's all the same dream for me.
Mm.
I was just figuring out my path to get there, but it was all the same dream. It was okay. In each point in my life, I reflected on how happy am I at the moment? Where do I want to go? What life do I want? And only the vehicle changed, but you're not going to know. Like, I wouldn't have known if I didn't try law. I wouldn't have known if I didn't try corporate sales. It's like, if you have a big vision or goal or dream for your life, you got to fucking start and try it. And then if it's like, if you really have given it everything for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, and it's not you, then fail quickly and pivot and find something new.
Yeah. No, so, yeah. I resonate with that. I think, you know, like even to how I got here, I knew, you know, similar to you when we talked about this, was I went to Gary Vee's event and I sat there through an entire day of back-to-back speakers and was falling asleep. And then Gary just at the end of the day, you know, said, I'm not here to sell you shit. Just go fucking start a business. And I was like, oh, that's all I need to hear, you know? But like for me, I think no matter what I was doing, whether I was a sales guy, you know, selling cars or vacuums or supplements or wherever I was at the time, I was always like giving it everything I had.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'm going to have the best damn month in this role, wherever I kind of was. It sounds like you almost had the same kind of attitude or energy. Like you just want to do really well and you want to inject yourself into creating success. So you were just channeling that into being a lawyer, then into acting, then into the sales role, and then into entrepreneurship. And then the vehicle clicked when you were like, oh, now I'm kind of happy doing this thing. Where do you think that comes from for you? Where do you think that drive that? Because a lot of people ask, like, where do I get that? How do I summon that motivation?
Yeah.
Like, where does that come from for you?
It's a really interesting question. In terms of like, you know, the motivation piece, everyone's like motivation versus discipline. Like you don't need motivation if you're disciplined. Yeah, that's true. But I think, again, this is like linked to my ADHD brain and stuff. Like, if I don't want to do something, good luck making me do it. Like, so like I've always had this, like, and this is something internal that I don't know where it came from. Like, again, none of my family were super ambitious people. My cousin was really smart and he's done really well in terms of in the finance world. But again, he's very risk adverse, very different to me. I just had this thing in me from very young age. And I say this because I know a lot of people that can relate. You feel like there's something special out there. You're meant to do something great while you're here. And then just society, responsibility, bills, teachers, bosses, they fucking beat that out of you, man.
Yeah.
But I didn't let that happen. But where my motivation comes from, it's like, yeah, some people say like motivation's bullshit. I disagree because, okay, yeah, you can be disciplined and do something, but wouldn't you be excited? Wouldn't you prefer to wake up and be excited to do it?
Mm.
So I think a big part of where my motivation comes from is linked to the visualization piece. But again, the biggest driver for me, whenever I'm stuck in any sort of funk in life, I always link it to, okay, just stop what I'm doing, reflect. Am I happy with where I am right now? Am I happy with what I'm doing each day? The goals I set a year ago, are they still in alignment with me? Yes. Okay, sweet. Do we need to change the tactics to get there? What do we need to do? Or a lot of the time, at times I'd be like, is that goal that I set 18 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, does that still align with me? If it doesn't, then then I can pivot and recalibrate based on a new goal. And when I visualize, like, I'm consistently generating motivation for myself, because when I visualize, I don't just visualize that end moment, right? Like, I'm visualizing every step along the way. There might be 10 steps, and each of those steps along, like, let's just say, who's a really cool podcaster right now? Like, let's just say I wanted to be on Diary of a CEO, right? Sick podcast, Stephen Bartlett, G. I wouldn't just visualize myself, you know, sitting across from him having this conversation.
Right.
There would be like, okay, what business am I going to be known for when we do that? Visualize starting that business and then certain point scaling it, and then maybe an exit and then starting this. And then I would visualize all those moments along the way. And because every day when I visualize, I'm emotionally experiencing myself living out all these fucking epic moments in my life, it genuinely feels like I'm time traveling. And, you know, as people, as you would have heard, like, when you visualize, allow yourself to experience the emotions like they're real.
Mm.
Like, go there, experience it. How do I every day living my dreams in my head, experience them like I'm there, like I'm time traveling to the future, and then I stop, I come back. How am I not going to be excited to go to work and put the work
right,
in?
Right, because it's almost like, you know how like the human brain, it wants to keep something, it's losing more than it wants to attain something. So they did this interesting study. I can't remember where it was, but they had a Ferrari dealership, and they had two different sales teams. One of the sales teams, they said, if you hit this target, we'll give you a Ferrari. And the other sales team, they said, here's a Ferrari. If you don't hit your target, you're going to lose it. Which team do you think kept the Ferraris?
Well, the one that was going to lose it, I imagine. Where are you going with this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So losing something is actually more motivating than, right? So then would you say that by proxy, when you're visualizing your potential future and what you're going to do, you try to actually feel it as if you have it. Then when you come back into the present, you're like, okay, I want to actually create that now.
It's really interesting. I never thought about it like that, but I would have to agree, because my biggest fear is not realizing my potential.
Mm.
Because I know I've felt it so many times, because I've gone so deep with these visualizations for so many years. I've seen my life in the future. I've felt it. I've lived it. If the biggest tragedy in my life would be to be on my deathbed and realize I played it safe, or I didn't put everything I had in, and I didn't get to live that, because I know it was there for me.
Yeah.
It's my biggest fear is like unrealized potential.
So at what point did you start this visualization process, and at what point did you start to think, I want to realize my potential, I don't want to just play it easy?
Well, I'd been doing it my whole life. The first time I remember visualizing something, again, I just...
It's like from a childhood?
From a childhood, yeah. I was in year four. First time I can remember visualizing something into existence.
Okay.
I had a crush on this girl. Yeah. I can't even remember her name. I can't even really remember what she looks like. But I remember, this is actually my first acting experience, funnily enough. We're in year four, and we were doing this like play, you know, to put on at the hall for the school. And I had a crush on this girl. And there was like 30 different roles, right? And it's like, we found out what we're doing. The next day, we're all going to go in and draw for who gets what role.
Mm-hmm.
And remember thinking, I want to be this lead guy character, and I want her to be that. So we get to, you know, be together in the play. And I remember so clearly, I visualized that. I wanted to make it happen so bad. And the next day it gets drawn and we get picked at those two roles. I'm like, what the fuck?
So then you just believed it.
I just continued doing it, not knowing it was visualization until I read The Secret.
Yeah.
And then I realized, holy shit, I've been doing this my whole life.
Wow.
So it was at that point, I then did it consciously rather than just, I was doing it because when I would daydream, all I would daydream was about my goals and moments in my life wanted to happen anyway.
Right.
Which is, I don't know, isn't that what everyone daydreams about? Or
yeah,
daydream
like
about
interestingly enough, like I read The Secret when I was like, a kid, but I actually saw it first as like the documentary thing.
Yeah,
I was like,
Netflix,
I was like
yeah.
11 or 12 or something like that. And my mom was obsessed with it. And I remember going, wow, I can have whatever I want if I just imagine it. You know what I mean? So like, similar to you, I have, I'm creative. I have a big imagination. But when I was a kid, I used to try to manifest things. And sometimes, you know, I would get the bike or the skateboard or whatever the thing I wanted was. But like, weirdly enough, in business, when I started the agency, I had a vision of, I'm going to create a giant agency. And I imagined an office and it was full of people and all the rest of it. Like it sounds weird and woo-woo, man, but like even if it's, let's just argue, even if it's not true, right? Even if it's just you are feeling the emotions you want to feel, having a taste of it, and then getting G'd up to go and actually create it.
Exactly.
Like even if it's just that, it's special. It's worth the investment.
And this is I've had.
That I believe argument. There's something to it.
Yeah,
but
I've had that argument with people. I said, like, I believe in the energetic pull of the universe and thoughts of power, all that sort of stuff. For that, it's not everyone's cup of tea, right? But like you said, even if that isn't real, how are you not going to be more motivated and excited to go in action, put the work in? Because you're every day you're generating motivation for yourself,
right?
And if you're not, you're not doing it right. You're not thinking about and experiencing things that you really want.
It's like dyno testing your own engine.
Exactly.
It's like, what's this thing made of? How far
exactly?
Can we go?
Yeah. So that's I love that you said that. I 100% agree.
Okay, and then so at what point did you start to realize, okay, let's pick this product, let's go live? Like, take me through that brand creation process, because a lot of people that are trying to create their own e-commerce brand, they're trying to find that hot product, they're trying to go live, they're trying to create the brand, pick a name. There's so many moving pieces to e-commerce. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you start to, you know, I guess, put everything together and have that, you know, what was it, like 3 months and you were hiring people and making, you know, millions of dollars and all the rest of it. So.
Yeah. So like a lot of businesses, it wasn't really clear what we were going to be from the start.
Yeah.
And even though I had met that guy in e-com, it wasn't always even going to be e-com. Like, I got together with George, who I started the business with, who he was part of the business for like the first 9 to 12 months. Fucking some of the most fun I've ever had in that first year. Your life's changing before your eyes. But it didn't start super clear. Like, we had a bunch of random stupid ideas, and one of them that I've spoken about before was a vegan dating app, which is, again, like, the vegan movement was...
It was a big movement, man.
It was a big movement. Obviously, everyone wanted to build an app and whatnot. And we just from the vegans we knew, they all wanted to date other vegans.
Yeah.
And then we realized how much, you know, building an app, we didn't have much money. We didn't have any technical experience. It was going to be an absolute shit fight. But so we luckily quickly we moved past that idea. And then I told him about, you know, that conversation I had with my mate in that had his little econ brand, and we had saw brands like Bondi Sands were massive. Obviously High Smile, who I mentioned earlier, we saw these.
So you know those guys?
I've met him a couple of times at events. I wouldn't say I know him.
But you were aware of them taking off and having success. Yeah.
And they were, I feel like, some of the OGs that really put e-com on the map in Australia. And we saw there was a pattern evolving of like two guys launching beauty brands. And we just thought, fuck. And like, it's happened many other times, like the Elias Skin boys, the Pink Clay Mask, they were two boys starting beauty brands. Like, some of the biggest beauty brands that started from like 2016 to 2020 was like all by guys, just randomly. Not that I'm saying fucking girls would be way better. I'm just saying that's just what, you know, that's just what happened.
You notice a trend.
Notice a trend. Yeah. So like, it didn't have to be. Yeah. So we knew what we wanted to be in beauty, because again, that's all, like, you know, most of the growth brands that we were seeing were in beauty. So we picked our niche. Again, fashion was something that had a lot of potential, but fashion's not really a brand I'd be starting first up. It's a lot trickier than people would think. So we wanted to be in beauty, but we wanted to do something new. Now, we absolutely hit the jackpot in terms of right product, right time. I'm not going to deny that. But there was a trend that was starting to emerge as well, like the DIY trend.
Okay.
And this didn't just exist in beauty. It was in gardening. It was in like fitness, like at home workouts.
What do you mean by DIY trend?
So do it yourself.
Right.
So again,
so rather than a woman going to a clinic, it was you were tapping into that kind of market.
Yeah. So like, again, those two, and I've spoken about these before, because they really were big inspirations to us. Bondi Sands, fake tan.
Yeah.
Before, when a girl wanted to do a fake tan, they'd go around to their salon, or their friend would come over, put up that tent, spray them, right? Until, you know, these guys put it in essentially like a mousse or whatever, a cream, you do it at home yourself. If you wanted to get your teeth whitened, 10, 15 years ago, how do you get your teeth whitened?
Yeah, you have to go to a dentist,
right? And then again, these probably weren't the first people to start these brands, but they were the first that we'd really heard of. So we think, oh fuck, that method, like that model of taking a product that's done in a clinic or a salon setting, that's expensive, that's, you know, repeat purchases that people have to go do it time and time again, it's more expensive and it's more time consuming, it's inconvenient. We knew if we could find a product that could take what was doing in like done originally in a setting like that, and give it to people where they could pay a once-off payment and do it in their own home whenever they want at their own time, it was a recipe for success. Very luckily, we got served an ad. It was a little drop shipping product for like a shaver. Just a cheap, probably cost $1, $2 to buy off Alibaba or AliExpress. It was a little shaver with a light on it, just for like, you know, electric shaver trimming your arms. And we saw that and we're like, is that is that a laser hair removal thing? And we looked into what it wasn't. And again, this, we were so early on in this piece, we didn't even know what Alibaba and AliExpress was. We didn't know where you could go. Like, there was a whole marketplace with manufacturers that would list their products and you could speak directly to them.
Yeah.
This is how green we were.
But like, that's what it was like back then. It was like you stumbled into this. I remember seeing it, I think it was like 2016. I was like, oh my God, there's this place you can buy anything from, but nobody knows about it. Yeah. It wasn't common knowledge like it is now.
I'd say it wasn't common knowledge until like 2020, 2021.
I remember friends getting into dropshipping and they were kind of like, it's like we found this little secret stash like, where we can get products
dude,
from.
It was when we first were like, don't tell anyone.
Yeah, don't
like,
tell this, anyone this about Alibaba. Yeah.
I feel like COVID really exploded that, like people realized during that time. But yeah, we found this and at that point, again, this just goes to show like how green we were, how grafty we had to be. Like we, from that point, we thought, okay, we tried to find the product. Again, we didn't know about these marketplaces, manufacturers. So where do we go? We go on LinkedIn. Let's find a product engineer. So we're messaging all these product engineers saying we have this idea for a product. How'd you execute it? They're like talking to us about their methods. Some of them are like burning off hairs. There was this product that we came across from the US. It's called like the No-No.
Yeah.
And it like literally like you don't shave your hairs off or anything. It just like burns your hairs off. Oh, and like we ordered one. It was extremely painful. It felt like it was going to explode in our hand. And then I honestly don't even remember how we must have spoken to someone and somehow we found out about Alibaba.
Mm.
And then we're like, holy shit, like we'd never seen any of these products before. The only place that you could get them and like, people think we invented IPL technology, like our own IPL handsets. We definitely didn't. Like Philips had.
So what's IPL stand for?
Intense pulse light. So it's different to the laser. Inside, like they do, it's still done in a laser clinic as well.
Mm-hmm.
But in a laser is like a one solid beam of light. IPL intense pulse light is broad spectrum, so it's like a wavelength. So it's not as strong and targeted, which is why you do it once a week from your home instead of, you know, once every 4 to 6 weeks at a clinic.
Yeah.
But you'll do it once a week for, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks, and you're going to get the same results as doing 6 sessions in a clinic. So it's a safer product that you can use at home. Again, that's why it was just starting to emerge. Like the lasers done in clinics, I still really haven't seen anyone selling proper laser at home. Like I'm sure the tech can be there. There's a technology called like NDAG, which is really good for like darker skin tones, because the reason IPL doesn't work on like really dark skin tones or really light hair is because it works off the contrast.
Oh.
Like it targets the root of the hair. So if you have like, you know, anywhere from light skin to medium complexion and you have dark hair, you're a perfect candidate for it.
Right.
If I was to use it with like light skin and like light hair,
so it'll work with me because I've
work,
got
work right
black
with you,
hair.
But the problem, like for me, if I was to use it, it wouldn't be super effective. It would work a little bit, but it doesn't have that much pigment to target. But if someone with really dark skin was to use it, it can't see the difference between the skin and the pigment of the hair. So it will blast the whole skin really targeted. And like people can, and we've seen competitors just sound like not really clearly communicating that and like people getting burns and things like that. So there's a technology called NDAG, which is made for people with the darker skin tones. And I've started to kind of see that, but it's really expensive. It's going to be good luck getting that listed with the ARTG. Right. So it is a little bit tricky. So Philips and Shaver Shop had them. Philips and Braun, you know, those big, you know, electronic companies.
So the big electronic companies had a similar product to what you were selling.
Yes.
But they didn't really, like when we looked at their branding, they didn't really have this cool influencer UGC at home feeling.
Nothing.
It was just like, here's a product with all the features and benefits and da 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 da.
They only started that, I would say, in the last, since COVID again.
The UGC stuff?
Working with influencers, running Facebook. They existed on the bottom shelf of Shaver Shop on the floor. So no one...
If you knew, you knew. If you didn't...
If you knew, you knew. If you didn't, you would thought we were geniuses that invented this product.
Yeah.
But again, we were geniuses to find it and brand it and market it the way we did. So we had to do a bunch of testing. And I remember we ordered products. And because, I'm not the ideal complexion and hair color, George did the original test for us.
Okay.
And we're just like, dude, this seems, we were the same as customers. One of the earliest obstacles we had to overcome was bullshit that actually works.
Yeah.
Right. And we were the same. We were like, dude, this seems like, and the price point, looked at what we could buy it for, what we could sell it for. We think this works as a business model, but it seems too good to be true. Like if this works, like we're fucking all in, like we know it'll be a great product. So he got it, used it. And he didn't tell me the first time he used it. He just used it twice. And he goes, dude, I want to show you something. And he pulled back his sleeve, his own long sleeve like this. And like the massive patches with our hair growing back after two uses.
Wow.
But we mainly say after 3 to 4 to be safe and set expectations. But after 2 weeks, I've still got the photos, like massive reduction in hair. So we're like, holy shit.
Wow.
We are like, this is going to work. And the next step, once we knew the product worked, was looking into all the regulations, the logistics, the electrical safety standards, all that sort of stuff, which took a few months because, again, brand new technology. And why it was so easy is because it wasn't even on the radar of the regulatory bodies yet. So yeah, it was all good. We ticked all the boxes we needed. We were fine to sell. So we saved a little bit of money, put in 10 grand each.
Yep.
Ordered 110 units of stock, only 110 because, again, it's a rather expensive product. Yeah. It's not like a $5, you know, skin cream product.
Would you encourage people to kind of move up the margin as high as possible when it comes to e-commerce?
You need you need to have at least 4x margin if you want to be successful in e-commerce.
Would you say there's a minimum price point that people shouldn't go below when they're selling a product?
It's changed now because of the power of TikTok and TikTok Shop, which will come to Australia soon. Like brands that are running, you know, $30 products are doing quite well. But if you want to be running... If you want to scale it beyond organic and beyond TikTok and run Facebook ads, because of what the CPMs are today and how competitive it is, if you have anything under $50, you're really going to struggle. I think the, you know, $70 to $80 as a minimum is kind of a sweet spot. I like the, say, $80 to $150 point is probably the biggest sweet. So we were on the higher end, like our AOV is about $250.
Wow.
So it is a little bit more expensive, which means like playing on TikTok with generally a younger demographic that spend on cheaper products isn't our strongest point, but again, influencer marketing, Facebook and Instagram ads really, really absolutely went ballistic for us. So we put all our cash into that. So
$20,000,
10 grand each, 110 units.
Yeah.
After that, I had about $1,000 in my bank account, but like, I was like, I'm all in on this.
Yeah.
You know, I had a job. I was probably getting $1,000 a week. So I'm like, still living at home. Like I can get by. Everyone thinks like, dude, wasn't that such a big risk to put like essentially 90% of your net worth into this idea? And again, everyone thinks you're crazy at the start, right? Yeah. Everyone thinks you're crazy. We did some shoots with people and everyone was like, oh yeah, like good luck, hope it does well. Like we were stopping people on the street, literally hundreds of women on the street, asking them, hey, I know this is random, but have you ever done laser hair removal before? Yeah. So are you still doing it? Yes. No. What did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? Why did you stop? And like all that information was coming back and like every single response was like, wow, this is like, it's too expensive, inconvenient, it was painful, I couldn't be bothered, I was lazy. Mm. So it's like, dude, we knew we had the perfect product just from that market research. Probably spoke to 200-300 women.
Wow, okay. Yeah. This is interesting. So that was after you ordered the product or?
This was before. This was like in the figuring out the logistics, the legalities, George was doing the test.
Right, before you actually put in the $10,000.
Yeah, so by the time we found the product idea, there was still 9 months in between then and launch.
Right. Okay. And then you talked to almost 300 women in that period.
Yeah.
Trying to understand how they felt about the problem.
Mm-hmm. We had really strong instincts in this that it was going to be successful because of how obvious a product it was. And like everyone, the best products are like when you launch it and everyone's like, fuck, it felt like that should already exist. You know, like it just makes so much sense. But hearing the feedback from these women, everyone was like, we didn't tell them what we had coming or why we were asking, but they were all just saying it was too expensive. I would have loved to keep going, but you know, I couldn't afford it, or, you know, I was lazy to book an appointment. It was inconvenient for me. So like, we just, every time someone's saying this, we're just like, keep going. Like this is like exactly what we want to hear. So again, even if we didn't get the best feedback, I think we still would have went ahead with it because we really believed in it. And sometimes you can't trust what a couple of people say. You have to really put it out there and see what happens. But yeah, so we had 110 units. 10 of them were to send out to influencers. 100 were to sell. The first day we got our first sale. Again, I've told this story before. It's pretty funny. Got our first sale. 11:30 at night. I'm just going to bed. George calls me. He's like, dude, we just got our first sale. I was like, fuck, are you serious? He's like, yeah, someone like purchased from a Facebook ad. We were probably only spending like $50 a day at that point. So it's like, good ROAS, get out of bed, drive over to his place, which is like 5-10 minutes away, crack a bottle of champagne, we're at the park across the road from his house, just like where we had done so many like just visualizations, not purposeful, but we're just talking about all of these things we're going to achieve with the brand. Like that was like where we'd work all day at his place and we'd go across the road, we'd have a bottle of champagne, we'd look up at the stars and we'd just talk and just be like, we know all this is coming, we know all this is coming. And like, dude, because we put so much of that out there and we'd put the work in. Again, law of attraction isn't you sit there and think about it and you hope for the best. You use that as part of your tool. Like you have to then use the energy you're putting out to the universe, using the motivation you've created to fucking put the work in as well. Like we were working full-time jobs nearly every night. We'd then meet up from 7 to midnight, go home, go to bed, wake up in the morning, go to work, go home, quick shower, gym, you know, eat, and then go. We're working like 5 hours a day after work and then most of our weekends. So it's not like we just sat at a park and visualized it into existence. Like there was so much work that went into that as well. So first day, one sale, sweet. Second day, no sales. We're like, that's fine, man. Like, again, we knew it was going to be slow. It's a brand new piece of technology.
Yep.
We thought it was going to take a while to get adoption because, again, does it work? Does it hurt? Is it safe? Like those are the main ones.
A lot of question marks around the product.
A lot of question marks. But we had used it, tested it. We knew it might take a little bit of time, but we had belief it would take off. It was Wednesday. We had our first influencer go live, who Davey Lloyd, we had him on the podcast a couple months ago. He was from the Bachelor in Paradise series. Now, we didn't even know when we sent him the product he was going to be on the show. We sent it to him like a month before they went live. He had like 20,000 followers by the time that we got him to post, because a couple little delays in terms of launch, because he's on TV 4 nights a week, he had went from 20,000 followers to 50,000 followers. Now, we were so lucky because I'm sure if he had 50,000 followers by the time we reached out, he would have wanted money. We didn't really have that much money to pay people. So at the start, it was just gifted. So we sent him one product. He posted at about 7:30 at night. We had made $5,000 by midnight. By the time we woke up in the morning, it was like $7,500. And like, think about it. We were earning $1,000 a week. We put $10,000 in each, and like we'd made $7,500 back from one post. So then I emailed everyone that I could contact, whether it be Instagram, DM or email, emailed every single person on that show saying, hey, we'd love to work with you.
Wow.
So
you weren't just going to rest there. How do I get my next hit?
As quick as we can. Like, dude, you start hearing those Shopify cha-chings go off, your life changes. Your life changes forever.
So you started actively reaching out to
everyone immediately. Yeah. And they must have been speaking to each other, because every person we'd work with, the price would go up $50, $100, $200. Like by the end, we were probably paying like $700 a post, but it was fine, because even the ones that didn't work well would still make us back like $1,000 minimum. The good ones would make us like $5,000 to $10,000. And then we started just scaling that like massively, like, okay, find a group of influencers that work and then get it in their hands. Because it was a brand new product, all we needed to do was get the product in front of people's faces with people that they have an emotional connection to or some element of trust.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'll go in. If you're on that, we'll go in.
Wow. And do you feel like at some point women started to realize, predominantly, I imagine women are the predominant consumer, they start to like send referrals and then do testimonial videos? Like how did it percolate beyond just the initial influencer groups?
Yeah. So the biggest way, again, the part of it was always going to happen. And that's why we were so patient with it. We knew that the word would spread, right? We knew the word would spread and people would tell their friends about it, but like you can't really control how fast that happens. And even though influencers, I can, you know, email or DM influencers all day, if you have one influencer posting a day, like that's a lot of work to organize. And we did that for years, but it's a lot of work to organize. But like, it's still not that, it's like very manual process to scale. It's once we figured out Facebook ads, and then it's like, we can go from spending $100 a day, if that's profitable, 200, if that's profitable, 500, if that's we were spending like within, I'd say by the end of the year, by Black Friday, we fully figured out ads. We launched in April. So by November, we figured out ads. And then throughout the whole next year, what was that, 2019, like, spend 10, 12, 15 grand a day on ads, like
a day.
A day.
Wow. So in the beginning, you caught on with the influencer side of things. Mm-hmm. So just out of curiosity, like let's go into that. Like how does someone make sure when they are using influencers? Because people try to do this and fail miserably. Like what are some of the tactics or the methods or the things someone should be thinking about if they're using influencers to do marketing with them?
Yeah, so it's one of the biggest things that people get wrong with influencers. They look at their followers and they look at the influencer themselves.
Right.
Influencer themselves. Now, you might there might be an influencer, say you have a fake tan brand, right? Yep. You might be looking at an influencer who's a beautiful girl. She has 1 million followers. You think 1 million followers, great. Mm-hmm. Followers don't mean anything for a start. And then you think, okay, this chick is definitely our target market. She's who buys our product. She's posting bikini. She's going out to the beach with her friends. Awesome. She's got a big following and she's our target market. I'm going to pay you $3,000 to post our product because I feel like you're going to work really well. But to me, that never made sense, because it's like, you're not trying to sell to the influencer. You're trying to sell to her followers.
Yeah.
And that's where so many brands go wrong. It's like, okay, instead of doing that, obviously there's loads of like third-party software tools that scrapes down analytics and tells you who their followers are, you know, what their demographic, what countries they're from. Again, it's not always 100% accurate, but it's pretty good. All you need to do, man, is click on who's commenting on their stuff or who's liking it and just scroll through the names. Are they female? Do they look like they're from Western countries where you sell? If you can do that, if you can click on influencers' likes and just, you have to scroll through them and look, are they real people, number one?
Right.
Are they the right sex? Yes, no. But like, if they tick all those boxes and like you can, we called it like clean, are the followers clean? Like, do they look like their followers are made up from the people that are buying our products? Mm. Yes. Sweet. We know we can chuck heaps of money
so
at them.
And manually check.
Manually.
Yeah.
But otherwise, like so many like bikini brands, because like who follows bikini girls?
Probably guys, I
mainly
imagine.
Guys. Yeah. Like some of them will be girls, but mainly guys. How many bikinis are you going to sell if you're setting up? Like, yeah, obviously some guys will have girlfriends, but like the guys that have girlfriends probably aren't like liking these bikini girl photos every day, you know?
Yeah, otherwise they're probably not engaging.
Going to get in trouble pretty quickly. Yeah. They better not be, yeah.
Right.
So yeah, just looking at the not worrying about the who the influencer is themselves. Like,
yeah, who's their tribe? Who's following them?
Who's their tribe? Like, again, I said Davey Lloyd was the first influencer we worked with. Jake Ellis was one of the second. Like, these are guys. Who like
girls follow?
Girls follow.
Yeah,
exactly. Wow. So that's it. Like that. Those are the big ones.
So don't assume. Actually, you have a look under.
You
the
have
hood.
To. You have to have a look under the hood. You have to think about who are you trying to sell to, and who's your target market, and do they line up? Yes. And then another big thing that people get wrong with influencer marketing is they don't understand what makes good value to them. Now, because we're working with so many influencers, we have this spreadsheet that we created where it was like value to cost ratio, right? And there's no way you're ever going to know how well an influencer is going to convert until you work with them.
Right.
But you can get an idea by looking at historical data and how well certain people worked. And it's like, again, remember, we don't want to look at followers. That doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's engagement rate. Like how many people are actually engaging on their stuff.
Right.
Right. So we'll look at the likes and comments, mainly the likes for this, comments as well. But we look at the likes because we know those people are definitely seeing it and they're definitely paying attention enough to like, right? So you're not going to know how much someone's going to convert, but what you can do is, okay, look, what are they charging us? So this influencer is charging us $1,000 per post,
right?
She gets 10,000 likes on average. So that's like, we get for every dollar, we get 10 likes, right? Whereas some, because again, you need to figure out what's good value. So we put all this in, we put what they're charging us per post, we put their average from their last 12, how many likes they get, and we can see, okay, per dollar, this one is 10. Per dollar, this one is 36. Per dollar, this one is 2. So then you start to look at, okay, the best way to know how something's going to work is you first have to look at, are their followers the right people? Once you've ticked that box, sweet, you know, if I pay for them, I'm going to be hitting the right sort of people.
Right.
But then how do we work out what's good value?
Hmm.
You put that in the value to cost ratio, and then you can very easily see, you can sort it by that. Okay, here's all the ones that are really good. They're really good value.
If we pay a dollar here, every dollar gets 40 likes.
Exactly.
Whereas over here, it gets 2.
Exactly.
So even though this might be apparently the most relevant influencer, maybe that's not the case because you've vetted out their tribe, not the right tribe, or they are, then it's like, you know, are we being cost effective?
Yeah. And we use that. We scaled, we were doing millions of dollars just from influencers.
Wow.
Yeah. Just from influencers directly.
Were there other things you would look for? Like, you know, were you trying to find personalities, or were you trying to find people that align with the stylization of the brands? Was there anything else that was relevant to you?
Yes, that mainly evolved as the brand grew. Obviously at the start, you just like give it to everyone, but there were certain,
just get the attention,
not give it to everyone. Like there were certain like categories of influences that, well, again, that we didn't really have to think about that because the people that were following them dictated that.
Mm-hmm.
So the people that we wanted to target weren't following the wrong sort of people.
Right.
They had way different following. So we didn't have to be like, okay, this person's partying all the time, or they're a bad role model, or they're too controversial. Like because we worked with a lot of reality TV people at the start.
Mm.
We turned down some of them as well because they were the ones causing all the controversy and we didn't want to align with them. So, but generally if their following was clean, what we called it, like they're highly female, their names and profiles look like they're from Western countries. And I don't say Western countries fucking, that's where we sell.
Mm.
Like if you see it and they're all Russian looking names, they're all like from Asia or India or Brazil, you know, that if they're real, they're not who you want to sell to anyway, but there's a good chance that they're fake accounts or bots anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then, so yeah, you vet them out, make sure that the tribe's relevant, and then you try to get a good investment on cost. And then all the success of the money you had from that, then you started investing into ads and making sure that you were accelerating the ads from $50 a day through to $15,000 a day. Did it get to the point where you started to feel overwhelmed? Like there was too much happening? Because I know you said after the first year you had what, 12 employees?
Maybe eight. We probably by like into the second year we had like 12, 14 employees. Like that's when I realized that shit's starting to change. But because George left, George the main that started the business with, and then I had to, because he was doing mainly at that stage, like operations, finance,
right,
that sort of stuff. And I was doing like mainly, well, we were all working everything, but the main stuff, I was doing all the influences, all the copy, like the post, and I was
sounding like you guys had a good yin and yang thing going on.
Yeah. So when he wanted to leave, I had to find someone to, you know, do all that stuff. Like it definitely would have been, and again, this is where like I feel like it was a little bit difficult for me in the sense that, okay, we had just both, you know, owned our own two things, and it's like I'm already have a business doing probably by that point, close to 10 million already at that point, like high seven figures, and it's like, fuck. Now I don't get the opportunity to learn all that from the start. It's like, I can't just learn all that from, we're already at this point. I can't. So I had to hire like someone to handle all that stuff. And luckily my cousin, who's extremely intelligent, way smarter than me, he's the one I mentioned that had done really well in the finance world. I said, hey, I've got to hire someone. I'm going to give them a little bit of equity. Can you just read over the JD and the numbers with me just to make sure like it seems like, putting together something that makes sense, because I already had some people lined up that I was going to have meetings with and suss them out and see if I wanted to work with them. And I showed him, and then he's like, I think he didn't really understand what sort of numbers we were doing as well and the bottom line we were making. So he's like, wow, like I remember him saying, Dylan, you're like, and this, he didn't think this when I was coming over, neither did I. He's like, I can help you with this stuff. I was like, really? He's like, yeah. And he'd already been at his role, big, you know, billion-dollar company for 5 years. He was kind of ready for a new challenge, and he was traveling far as well. I said, if you're keen, like that'd be a dream come true. So yeah, he quit his job like a few days later. Wow. Massive, massive job with a really big company. And then he came in and took over all that stuff. And then we realized like we had just, you know, grown for the sake of growth, you know, doing probably like $1 million plus a year in Europe and all these different countries and like the UK. And like when we looked at it, like we're putting a lot of energy and budget into these spaces, but by the time you pay the shipping, the returns, the VAT, it wasn't really worth us being in certain markets. So we did pull back and tightened up, and we just focused on our core markets, and that made things a little bit easier, because if we didn't have him come in at where we did, we would have wasted, like he probably saved us hundreds of thousands of dollars in the first year in terms of margin.
Yeah.
Hundreds, yeah. Paid for himself.
How important do you think it is for someone in e-commerce to have that numbers kind of person? Because it sounds like your friend at the beginning was very much like number oriented, and you were very like creative by the sounds of it. And you guys played off each other's strengths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you need to understand it from day one. Like a lot of people, again, if you have a business partner you can trust and you can go into business with them, I think that's great. I still prefer running businesses with people, because like it's like not only is someone there for the lows, it's actually what you want someone there more for is the highs, to celebrate the highs with the wins. It's like when your life's changing, you're doing, you know, $10,000 in a day, or you've just, you know, whatever, and then you're showing your friends your screenshots and it's like everyone's like, holy shit, this is so exciting. Everyone's really happy for you. But then it gets to the point a few months in where he's like, I'm just going to keep bragging. Look at all this money I'm making to like your friends. So like you lose that. But e-com, again, by the time you're doing like, you know, 10 million a year plus, even anything like more than probably like 4 or 5 million a year, like it's very difficult to learn at that point because there's so many moving pieces. But e-com actually is quite simple. Like you can track everything you need to track in one Excel spreadsheet. And it's like, spend a bit of time to learn that. Even if you do have a business partner, spend a bit of time to learn that, because like it's part of business. And if you're getting into business, like you better plan to be in business for like 10, 20 years. Like this isn't like a 1 year thing. You're going to make heaps of money and retire. That's not realistic. So e-com actually isn't that difficult. Like all the numbers you need to understand can be put onto one spreadsheet, and just understand that. You don't need to be a whiz. You don't need to be a mathematician, but understand your margins, understand your cogs, understand where you're profitable in terms of your ads, understand at what point, particularly like with businesses scaling, people will be like, and I see a lot of agencies that'll be like, we're getting you a 14 ROAS. Yeah, but you're spending fucking $150 a day. Yeah. Wouldn't you rather spend $2,000 a day and get like a 5 ROAS? Like, let's do the numbers there and see what you're making more net profit dollars.
Right, so maybe sometimes people focusing on the wrong numbers as well.
Because like e-commerce changed the game. Like so many old accountants or old marketing firms would be like, okay, what's your marketing budget for the quarter?
Right.
Like, dude, my ROAS, particularly, like it's changed slightly, but it's like your ROAS dictates, particularly in the growth phase. It's like if we have like a ROAS of like 5, I'm not going to keep it there. I'm going to try and double the budget and still get a 4.
Yeah.
But like people be like, okay, no, we're performing really well. We don't want to increase these budgets because then our client's going to be really happy. Hey, look at this ROAS we got you. But realistically, like you're limiting your growth. And like in e-com, if you have a new product, it's just a matter of time until it's inundated with competitors. You need to take market share as quickly as you can.
And spend as much as possible.
Spend as much as you can, acquire market share, build your brand before the competitors go in, because we've had hundreds of competitors pop up and all die because they didn't have the brand, because they weren't there first. Like they didn't have that credibility. So you need to take market share really quickly, and you're not going to do that with set and forget marketing budgets.
Yeah. So how much would you say the success of your e-commerce store really relied upon your ad spend? Because I sometimes meet people and they're trying to launch an e-commerce store, but they don't yet have the budget to do ads, right? Like, what's your advice to the person bootstrapping it?
Yeah.
What should they be trying to do with their e-commerce store?
Yeah, it's a lot harder today because CPMs, you know, all the big, you know, global brands weren't really spending much of their marketing budgets on Facebook 6 years ago. They are now. So I wouldn't really, again, you can, and a lot of dropshippers will still run ads on Facebook, but your CPMs are going to be like much higher on average than they used to be. But right now what's working really well, and this is a lot of what I teach to the brands, particularly the people that don't have big budgets. If you have budgets or it's your second business and you got a little bit behind you, then you can play in a few different fields at once. But what's really cool now is with introduction of like TikTok and Reels, like how much organic reach you can get for free. Like all you need to do is tell a good story, have good content. And like you're sitting at the back of the room, like him and his partner have a brand, Alia Bottle, and they're fucking absolutely killing it. And they barely spent anything on ads. They've made, I won't say how much, but they've made a good amount of sales just from organic content. So first step now, where it's leveled the playing field. You need to, again, some people be like, but I don't want to be on camera. Well, it's like you can do a product focused TikTok account, but you're limiting yourself. Like so many of the TikTok brands in business, the ones that pop off and make people so many sales, is it's like it's the product, and some businesses, depending what the product is, if it tells an emotional story, you can focus on the product and the transformation the product gives and tie that into human psychology and emotion, and that'll be really effective. But most of the time, if you have a product, for example, like a laser hair removal thing, how emotional can you make that product for a person? Like it is, and it is creating real change in their life and adding something really, really special to their lives. But realistically, that's not going to go viral. People don't really care enough. But hey, this startup, you know, bootstrap, you know, I'm packing orders after my work. Watch me pack orders. So we're placing our bulk order. This is so much money for us. Like, tell that story, that real organic hustle story from the start, and tell it in your own unique way.
Like peeling back the veil of like, I am starting up.
Exactly.
Like showing them story behind the company.
And it doesn't, not every TikTok account has to be founder led. No. But I've seen a lot of people that have been really successful with that. So it's like now, like your first step can just be get like make 30 pieces of organic content. Then start posting them, and let's just see what happens.
Right.
Like you don't need to start running ads straight away. Figure out, like, post 30, see what's starting to work best, make more videos like that. You every day is thinking about what's a new content idea, what's a new angle. So you can make a lot of money just off organic TikTok and Reels these days. And now TikTok Shop is coming to Australia soon. I'm still waiting for it. It's in the US, in the UK, it's in parts of Asia now. Then that way you're getting all these millions of views or hundreds of thousands of views on TikTok. You don't even need someone to click on your profile, then onto the link. You'll be able to check out right on TikTok. It's making it such a seamless process. And then the fees that they're taking is only 5%. So it's like someone's after paying. So that's step one. And then you can start running TikTok ads, start boosting it on there if TikTok's where you're booming. And then you've made enough money, then we can start. And you've built a bit of a brand, you can start running ads. It's different. I wouldn't recommend a startup with like $300 marketing budget start spending money on Facebook ads straight away.
But anyone can make content. Anyone can tell their story. Yes, it might make you uncomfortable, but there's beauty in being vulnerable and just showcasing, hey, I'm this startup entrepreneur. Because I think, you know, there's been times where I watch my partner, Ellie, buy something from another female entrepreneur because she's like, oh, I want to help them.
Yeah, massively.
I like this person. Massively. She makes content every day. I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. So let me buy $400 worth of it.
Exactly. But it's like, if it's a product that they would potentially use, yeah, and like, this is what happens. Like,
well, I kind of want it. And I have, you know, a sense of like caring about this person's story. Yeah. Like, why not?
Yeah. And like, you, I'm sure you've seen the memes of the posts like calling this shit out. It's like, Kylie Jenner, you know, launches a new lip kit, everyone fucking buys it without question. But your friend starts a business, they've put all their time and spare cash into. It's like, oh, do you have a discount code for me? Right. Can I get a half price of freebies? It's like, fucking support, you know, support your mates, you know what I mean? So TikToks has just scaled that massively.
Yeah. No, that's interesting, man, because like even, you know, when I started my business, there's always this sense of like, you know, do my friends really support me? Do they really want me to do well? And it's always surprising, you know, to hear people ask for freebies. Like when I was freelancing, people were like, can you help me design a logo for free? Can you? And I'm like, man, I'm trying to start a freaking business here, dude. It's not charity.
Yeah.
But I get it. So with the advent of TikTok, how much do you think TikTok's going to disrupt the game? Because I've heard different things. Some people are saying, oh, it's going to be an Amazon killer, this and that. Like, what's your opinion on what you anticipate may happen because of TikTok?
They're trying and they will be until the next thing comes along.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say it's kind of similar to what we had happen with Facebook with for a while there, maybe 6 years ago?
Yeah. Again, like it's a little bit different. I think in terms of native shopping, I think they're going to do really well. Like native shopping on the platform, they're going to do like Facebook Shop's been around for ages. I think TikTok Shop's going to have a lot more impact. But in terms of like their algorithm for running full funnel ads, so top of funnel, middle funnel, lower funnel, in terms of running just like a big full campaign on TikTok, it's not at where Facebook's is yet.
Okay.
If they can get their algorithm up to around where Facebook's is, which is, again, they've been trying and Facebook's algorithm is fucking really, really good for ads, but they've also been doing it for so long and they had a big advantage of doing a lot of this before all the privacy laws and the limited tracking and everything. So they've built a really good system there. So they will. The problem with TikTok is in it's like it's from the brands I've consulted with and the brands that I work with and even some of my own experience is like if they can attract an older demographic onto TikTok that has a little bit more disposable income and it's not just for the $30, $40, $50 products, then that can change the game. But really people don't look to spend hundreds of dollars on products. They definitely do, but it's much harder. Whereas Facebook, there's no limit. People sell like $700, $800 at-home saunas like nothing.
Yeah.
But on TikTok, you're going to struggle. It can develop, obviously.
So would you say that like if someone's looking at going all out in e-commerce or already is, that they should really take like social media content creation quite seriously?
Yeah, that's the first thing I would spend all your time on particularly. And that's the best because if you don't have a budget, all you need is your iPhone, maybe get a little ring light. That's it.
And then learn how to create stories.
And then just like look at, and you don't even have to be a creative genius these days. There's so many brands out there that are killing it that you can seek inspiration from. Yeah. What sort of content are they making? Okay, how do you do that in your own style with your products? Easy. Yeah. You don't even have to be a creative genius.
Modeling what other people are doing.
And like I said, it doesn't just have to be founder based. There's a lot of different cool product ideas and trends you can get involved in TikTok, but like a lot of it is like, this is why what you're doing, and I'm sure why you're experiencing so much growth, the rise of personal brands and the stories behind the brands. Mm-hmm. That's just like, I think that's going to be a massive theme over the next 10 years.
That's why we're here, man. And you know, I was inspired by Gary Vee, right? So I went to his event and I was like, how the fuck does this guy have like 1200 employees all around the world with multiple agencies working with Pepsi and Toyota? I'm like, he's just this guy on, he didn't even have anything he was selling. I'm like, what is he even selling? Right. Cause when he was in Brisbane, it just said 1-800-GARY, which I was too afraid to text because I was like, I probably can't afford it. I was broke at the time. But yeah, like his personal brand built his agency. So I stole that model. I was like, I wonder if I could build a personal brand and then leverage that attention to build an agency. And that's why I'm here 4 years later. But for you, you actually probably text that number and I heard that you spent, what was it, 11 days with Gary?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with Gary. It was really, really awesome experience. I think it was 3 days, it was 10 days, 3 days in Sydney, 3 days in London, and 4 days in New York.
Wow.
Yeah, it was completely a life-changing experience again because that was, I was in New York with him in January 2020. So I was in New York like right before Central Park was like a fucking COVID hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, I was there right before everything kicked off. And so was that 2020. Yeah. I launched the business 20 months beforehand. So I went from having $1,000 in my bank account, living in Preston's, working, you know, in a corporate job, doing that too. I'm fucking in New York City, sitting this far away from Gary, drinking a wine, level 40, 50, whatever, looking around at the Manhattan skyline thinking, holy shit. Life's crazy. Life's a game, man. You can make life whatever you want. It was a really, and people ask me, so what's some of the biggest things you learn? And like, I've got 30, 40, 50 pages of notes, but it's like, that's the problem with these events. Like you go and do, how often do you go back and read your notes? It's just, I changed.
What changed in you spending that much time with someone like Garrett? Because I imagine it'd be quite, not intimidating, but quite imposing. You're hyper-analyzing this individual that you have a sense of admiration for.
Well, in terms of that, it was really inspiring in the sense that what you see on camera is how he is every second of every day. You can put a camera out on Gary and any moment is a clip. Like he's so authentic. Like, and people be like, oh, it's all for show. He's exactly how he is on every video, every podcast, every clip you see. He's like that 24/7. And because I was, there was probably in New York, there was maybe like 10, 12 of us. It was a pretty small group.
Yeah.
And I was by far the youngest and everyone had been in business for like so much longer than me. Like most of the people I was hanging out with are at least 10 years older than me. So just even being with them and hearing how these people that operate and how they see opportunity and when you have money, how you go to the next level. And I guess some of the biggest stuff I learned from Gary was about his whole content approach and his media team. Like he has like 30 people just in Team Gary V.
Wow.
Just on his personal brand, 30 people.
Yeah.
Mental, right?
That's just making his content.
Yes. And that's where it's like, it really inspired me to like came back, wanted to start the podcast. And again, like this goes back a little bit to what we were talking about earlier in terms of like having a business that really aligns with your personal interests and passions. It's like, I talk about Happy Skin Co a little bit, but it's like, how much can I align my personal brand with laser hair removal?
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, but I learned a lot about the whole scaling up process in terms of you setting up systems and content and how to go to mass market appeal and all of that sort of stuff. But really what I learned was just like, I saw the world for the first time through this way. Like I said, I was this kid, grew up in a little pocket of Sydney in the suburbs. And I realized like in New York, like you realize why it's like, why they've got all the cliches, the city that never sleeps. You can make it here. You can make it anywhere because like, fuck. Shit is on another level over there. You think you're working hard. You think you got connections, relationships over here. You have no idea.
Yeah.
You have no idea.
Yeah. I met a few people from New York and they always have like this, it's a different aura, you know, like on the weekend going by, I had the honor of hanging out with Andrew Schultz and his team.
Oh, we saw that on the way here.
Which is wild, bro.
Yeah. Which one are we podcasting with? I'm like, unfortunately, on the right. No offense, bro.
Yeah.
No, I was there as well. To my brother. It was fucking good. You're funny, right?
Dude, it was wild, but it was so cool hanging out with them behind the scenes because a lot of their crew are like, you know, because you know Andrew Schultz grew up in New York and his team are from like, it's just being around people that have that much success. You can feel it. Like there's an aura and there's a, it almost like being around that energy pushes you to go, what else do I have?
Yeah.
Like if this person's pushing themselves this hard, like Gary Vee or Andrew Schultz to whatever their dream is. I think Andrew Schultz just did 20,000, 25,000 in Madison Square, where he's about
to. Done that. Yeah. So he's dreamed to sell out Madison Square Garden.
And he sold it out, which is insane. But you spend time with these people, you've had the honor of spending time with Gary Vee. Like, what do you think it is about being around someone that's in the pocket of greatness that rubs off on you and it's contagious?
Yeah. It's very contagious. Yeah. And you realize, what you thought was like, there's a reason why they're great. They're not just lucky. Like there's a reason why they're great. And you don't see in Australia, you don't see that a lot. You don't see that level of like executing at that level. Like Gary will have a meeting on one end of the office and he'll have another one in 2 minutes on the other end of the office. He'll have a meeting walking there.
Wow.
It's like so nailed in. Like every minute of his calendar is like dialed. And just seeing the way like these people operate, the way they move, it's so different to anything I'd ever seen. And obviously I was a young guy. I didn't have loads of corporate experience, but I'd work for people like, you know, 500 employee headcounts and like the CEO would look like any other random person on the street.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. I don't know if it's like, it's not like charisma doesn't necessarily make you a great entrepreneur, but it like, it's magnetic. And like, if you're a magnetic person, you attract opportunity and experiences your way.
Yeah, I think people want to be around someone who's magnetic and captivating. Like for example, Andrew Schultz definitely had this aura about him that his team, you could tell his team admired him. They respected him. When I met him, he was very friendly and courteous and respectful. I gave him a gift and he's like, make sure we take this back with us. And I was like, that made me feel warm and fuzzy.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
even like right after his show, they were debriefing. They were immediately like, how did this joke land? Did it land right the night before? It did better. What happened? Was it my body language? Like just immediately into how do we improve?
Mm-hmm.
Like you just sold out two back-to-back nights of 8,000 people.
On the other side of the world.
On the other side of the world. And then he's immediately like debriefing with his team. How do we make it better?
Mm-hmm.
So when we come back next time, we can do even more. And it was kind of awe-inspiring for me because I was like, wow, man, these guys have the upper echelons of success in the realm of comedy, but they're still like, how do we push it even further?
But it's like, they're that's why they're like that.
Yeah.
That's probably how they got there. And people just think, oh, these, and this is like a misconception that I see so many people have, and particularly coming from the suburbs, like if you're really wealthy or really rich, it's out of luck.
Yeah.
It's not, man. And seeing the way they execute, it makes you realize, holy shit. Like I thought I was doing well. No, I've got so much that I can improve on.
Yeah.
So much I can learn. Yeah. What do you put that, star quality in terms of a celebrity, can be entrepreneur. What do you put that? How would you best describe that quality? What do you think it is?
I think it's someone that is, you know, so if I look at Andrew Schultz, you know, love him or hate him. I love him. He's someone who's extraordinarily dedicated to his craft of comedy. He's like, how do I not just perform, but how do I push this industry to the absolute nth degree? How do I push myself to the absolute nth degree to make sure that, you know, when I'm performing, every body movement, every tonality, every facial expression, everything is engineered in comedy. A lot of people think comedy is just cracking jokes, but it's such a theatrical performance. And you're really trying to drive an audience's emotions for an hour and a half. Like, it's not easy to do that. It's not easy to drive an audience emotionally for that long. But I think, you know, having met him and having met Gary Vee, I could just tell that they really love what they do. Like, just so infatuated with what they do, so humble and in gratitude as well. Because I have met other people I'm not going to name names, but who are very wealthy and very successful and they're not happy. And you could tell that they're not vibing moment to moment, whereas someone like Gary is.
Massively,
So for me personally, it's not about the money, but it's about like, it's like, oh, this person's found their thing and they're so joyful because of it, which I find infectious, and I'm like, I want that. How do I work so hard that I can create the ability to have control over what I'm passionate about? Like what you were saying earlier, which is now you've made so much money in e-commerce that you could pack up shop and be good for a long time. And now you're trying to pivot into things that excite you, that pull that out of you. What is it that you're looking for now that you've had all the success and now you're moving into the next gear of entrepreneurship, which is maybe branching into other things?
Yeah.
What are you looking for now?
For me, I'm basing, you know, I always now that I've made a little bit of money, it's easy for me to do this. I always try and operate with my North Star of like fulfillment and happiness. Okay. Like, how do I wake up every day? Because it's like, I don't care about how much money I make if I fucking hate the process of getting there. And like you look back and you reflect on the journey I've had so far, and like it's so cliche, but what they teach you in school, the one thing that they really teach you right, it's not about the destination, it's the journey.
Right.
You know what I mean? And just really fucking enjoying that. And now it's like, what would I want to do if I could wake up every day and I had 10 billion in my bank account and I didn't have to do anything? What would I do? And think about, ask yourself that question. And again, I go back and forth, like, ask yourself that question. What if people don't really have much? I would go make a little bit of money first, because I feel like you can't have that freedom until you've ticked the financial security bucket first.
It's like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right?
Exactly, and that, yeah.
What would you say, like, because I guess I love asking people that question. Like, if you had a billion in the bank, what would you do? People freeze up.
I know what I would do.
Yeah. But that's the thing though, right? Like when people used to ask me that question when I was poor, I had an answer. I was like, I know what I want to do. It's this, you know, it's XYZ. For people that don't have that, it's maybe they need to sit with questions like that, or they need to, like, what's your advice to someone who's lost, who's like, I don't know what my thing is. I don't know where to start.
Well, the question, and it's what I just said, the question that changed everything to me is, okay, if you had all the money in the world and you didn't have to work, what would you do?
Right.
What would you do? Like, if you can't think of some things that you would truly love to spend your time on, I don't believe you. Like, what do you love to do? And it doesn't have to be anything specific that's, you know, generally connected to like, oh, I love finance. No, like, what's
it doesn't
your,
have
what's
to
your,
sound cool. It can be like, I love gaming,
exactly.
Whatever it is. Yeah.
Well, on it, like, there's a business. You can make any interest or any hobby these days a business.
Right.
Do that.
Yeah.
Like, do that, start. Like, and then you, if it's gaming, obviously you're not going to be able to create enough money from gaming overnight, but okay, go to a job where it doesn't completely stress you out and take out all your energy. So by the time you do get home, you're completely drained and all you want to do is have a wine, put your feet up and watch Netflix. Get a job that is, you don't absolutely hate, that you can go through the motions. It isn't a bad job. It pays you enough money to live comfortably enough. You might have to scale down your lifestyle. And this is the piece that no one wants to do. They've, you know, started earning, you know, 150 grand a year in a job they absolutely hate. And they've got this car and this house and they go to dinner here and they do all these things, but they're unhappy. But it's like the only way you're ever going to get out of that potentially is to take a step backwards, descale down your lifestyle, buy back some of your time. So then you can, on the side of, you know, whatever you're doing to pay the bills, you can start that business, that hobby, and build that to the point. And if you really want it and you're doing something that you really fucking love, then you should be excited to get home every day and put 3-4 hours in every weekday or on the weekend, spend your weekends building on that, because there's no way you're going to be stuck doing the thing you hate doing forever if you don't change something drastically.
Right. Yeah. So you think it's sometimes maybe people need to really almost have like a reality check, like I got to shake some shit up. Mm-hmm. I got to make some changes. And you were talking about this recently where you felt like maybe you were burning the midnight oil too much and you needed to set some boundaries. So on the other side of things as well, like for those that are working like ridiculously long hours, like in the hustle, maybe they have success. Like how does someone set up boundaries that are healthy for themselves?
That's completely individual to everyone. And and I think as well, like we've done a podcast tour and like I'm legit working from the second I wake up to like planning for the podcast the next day.
Yeah.
The minute I go to bed, but like, it doesn't feel like work because it's something I really love. Mm. You get drained and you get burnt out way quicker on things that you don't really love.
Right.
And I think it depends where you are at in life. Now I'm 30 years old. I have a serious partner. I'm in a relationship. I'm not single. I don't just like my priorities and boundaries have to change. Like I used to work most of my weekend. Now someone of the boys be like, okay, you want, can you meet up on, you know, Sunday at this time? Like I'm spending time with my partner. I can't.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's always different, but it's like, if you're not happy where you are, you're going to need to work harder than you are to change that for a bit.
Right.
That you can't change your life without the work to get there. You're not just going to be like, okay, I've decided I don't want to work this job anymore. I'm going to be a full-time gamer tomorrow. I'm not going to work. It doesn't work like that. And and that's the thing. I don't know. I feel very grateful for my brain being the way it is. And like, you're an ambitious person and you've clearly worked hard in many different industries to get to where you are today.
Yeah.
But I'm sure you've seen the same thing. You see people time and time again, I'm not happy. I want to do this, but they never actually do it.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I think for me, it's like they want maybe validation. They want someone to feel maybe sorry for them, or they you know, when people complain, they're like, I want attention essentially, but they don't really want to do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I almost put it down to there's not enough pain yet for that person to make the switch, or not enough pleasure for them to pursue it, right? So I'm sure you listen to Tony Robbins and he talks about there's two main drivers for human beings. It's away from pain or toward pleasure. And I think sometimes our toward pleasure can be not our future goals. It could be Netflix. It could be gaming. It could be eating, you know, snacks or drinking or social. Like we can fill in that joy with the short-term stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. And it kind of like masks what should be our long-term goal. So we can get a lot of easy, fast vices to fulfill the happy meters in our lives, at least temporarily. But the away from pain one is a big one for me, because what drove me into building an agency was like, At that time I was like, I don't want to work a job anymore. I want to create. For me, my pain was not being able to create, was selling mobile phones every day, which is like the least creative thing I could possibly think of at the time, right? But for me, pain for me was not being able to create and not having enough time in a day to create something. So then I started building this agency on the side to express my creativity. It wasn't even about money. I was like, I just want to control my income and do it with creativity. And then after 8 weeks, I was able to replace my income and go all into it, yep. Right? For me, I think it's sometimes people are masking their pleasure with things that aren't really going to help them long term, or not realizing the actual pain they're in and truly like, feeling it.
Like those vices are like bribing you to not chase your dreams.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But also at the flip side as well, it's like I feel like with like the culture that's developed over the past, you know, however many years, like I feel like everyone feels like they need to have this big grand dream. And I don't know if everyone really does want that.
Yeah.
Like they'll say they want it, but do they really want it? Or are you sweet earning 120 grand and your partner earning however much and you live a comfortable life and you don't need fucking 10 properties? You don't need to, you're like, just figure out like what you really want.
Yeah.
And like so many people, like I've got so many friends, obviously, because I grew up in the area. Oh, I've got this business. I want to start a business. Like starting a business isn't for everyone.
No, it's not, man. Entrepreneurship is not for everyone. It's not, it's not fun a lot of the time.
And sometimes I wish I didn't have to be like this.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, dude, like if I could, I've tried. I've tried to fucking get a job. I've tried to go to uni. I've tried to do all these things. Yeah. I can't, I have to do this.
Yeah.
It's like, and I, when I was acting, and this is another thing I reflected on, like there's a Robin Williams quote that I heard when I was acting, and because I thought I really wanted to do acting and I heard this quote and it didn't align with me, I'm thought, nah, that's bullshit. I don't get it. It's like, you should only act if you have to act. And I was like, nobody has to act. Like, it's like, there's like, no, like, because again, it's like the chances of success are so low. If you get into acting for the money, it's like buying a lottery ticket. It's like, I'm only in business because I have to be in business.
I see what you're saying.
I can't physically do anything else. Like it's what I have to do. Like, and if you're not that called to business because it is hard, like you said, a lot of the times it's shit, late nights, there's crisis meetings, there's emails, you just check an email and it ruins your day. It's like for most people that want to live being in business isn't a comfortable life.
No.
There's, you deal with a lot of shit and then you get to have some really cool experiences as well. My biggest thing was like, yours was expressing creativity. Mine was, I did not want to be told what to do.
Yeah.
I did not want to be, I wanted to have the freedom.
I had that bone in my body too, brother.
Yeah. Yes. I wanted to have the freedom to live life on my own terms. And that pain of being told what to do, be here at this time, do this work, email this person now, call this person, do this. Can I go home? No, staying to that pain was worse for me than the pain of having to put in all the work and all the late nights. I'd rather work 12 hours a day for myself than 8 hours a day for someone else. Mm. That's just me. I'm not saying everyone else should be like that.
No. A lot of people can relate, but yeah, I think you're right in saying that like you did it because you have to. And same for me, I tried so many different careers, so many different industries, different positions. I tried being a manager, I tried being a salesperson, I tried like retail, I tried a lot of different things. And I was like, I always end up just wanting to run the show myself. So it ended up just being, I would either offend the ego of the boss I work for by telling them how they should run their company, or I should just probably go start one.
Yeah. And it's like for both of us, a good example is like, a lot of times people ask like, oh, like were you this kid like you were doing like lemonade stands when I was 7 years old? No, I wasn't. Like I tried many different things to get here and I found what I love. And I think part of the reason I love business is because business doesn't have to mean one thing.
Right.
Business can be what we're doing right now.
Yeah, it's like there's so many different ways to get to 10, right? Like Vin Yang was saying. And I think you found your way, you found your thing, and like even how someone behaves as an entrepreneur is so different, right? You've got, you know, my background, and I think why I've had so much success as an entrepreneur is because I'm really a sales guy. Like I really know how to sell and I really know how to connect emotionally with a client and find out what they really want and make sure I get it for them, which is the sales process. And I don't mean it as the dirty word, but I mean the exchange. Mm-hmm. Like they want X result, I want X. How do we get something across the line so we both win?
Did you
win?
Do NLP as well?
I do NLP, yeah.
Yeah, do you feel like that? I know it's like a lot of mainly coaches and stuff can be really valuable for them, but what fields do you think NLP could be valuable for?
I think every human being could benefit off understanding what's really going on in their mind and in their body. And for me, NLP, it sounds like, you know, this big scary thing. It's just like getting a PhD in or a doctorate in understanding yourself. Like if you could open up your mind and have a look at what's happening inside of it, and if you could open up your habits, open up your feelings and just kind of like analyze yourself, like how valuable would that be?
Mm.
And I think so many times people have what we use in NLP called a limiting belief. You know, that stuff where people say, I hate reading. It's like, okay, that's a limiting belief because you've decided that at some point. You're only born with two fears, the fear of falling and the fear of loud noises. Now you're fearful of books. Why? You know what I mean? Like, who told you that? Where did you download it? Like, even for me, when I was 17, I used to say, I hate reading. I hate books, yada, yada. And someone said to me who was a NLP master practitioner, they said, why do you hate reading? And I was like, I fucking hate reading. They're like, why? Because I hate it. And they're like, no, let's actually have a conversation. They're like, why do you hate reading? I was like, well, in year two, I couldn't read and I got made fun of. And then it was like, you go down the rabbit hole and you're like, oh shit, there's a whole series of like coding or programming in my computer.
Yeah.
That's like reading is bad. And then you can change that code and go reading good. You know, and then I started reading. But like for me, I think NLP, even if someone just studies the basics of the human mind, I think if you can really understand why you're fearful and why you have the emotions you have and why you have the ideas you have, and if you could start analyzing yourself and reflecting and being present with your mind and your body, I think that would benefit so many people.
Yeah, I'm really interested in it. I think acting, because what I was studying was a technique called Meisner technique, and it's not NLP. No, it's
what
not,
is
it's
it?
Definitely not. It's called Meisner technique.
Meisner technique.
Sanford Meisner, Meisner.
Okay.
And so the whole technique is based. So, well, there was two things I really got from acting that really helped everything. Is the emotional preparation and connection. I understood. I had to break myself down. I understood all the things I'm most afraid of, what motivates me, pleasure, pain, all that sort of stuff. So I, again, like when I went through emotional preparation, a lot of males will struggle to cry. Like girls will be like, oh, first class, they're crying.
All right.
Guys, it can take a little bit. So like once you've broken that down and you can free up your emotions, like now, like I can watch a movie and I'll cry. Like it's the best.
Yeah.
Like being fully expressing your emotions, the highs, the lows, everything. In my opinion, it's part of being a human. So I really got that from acting, but also Meisner technique, how it works. So obviously like, you know, like what is it? 90% of communication is nonverbal, right? Mm. So essentially it's based off that premise. It's like, we will have a conversation using only like certain words. Like I'll just call out your behavior, say, yeah, you're concentrating, and you say, I'm concentrating. So like you got to communicate without using words. And so I'm communicating with my behavior, my tonality, my body language. But the thing that makes me react is I have to look for and watch in the tiniest little nuances, changes in your behavior as well. So you get really tuned into the other people's behavior and their motivations. And to get every scene that you watch on a program, a TV show, a film, both actors have a want. They have something they want from the other person, right? But the script is the script. You can only talk using the script. So it's like you have to use these different tactics, charming, scolding, whatever it may be, to get what you want, but you have to be so present and reacting off the other person's body language. So I got a lot out of that, which then, you know, helped me with communication and marketing and all that sort of stuff. So
right.
I feel like it's not always like, yeah, you get a lot of value out of these different things, and it isn't always what you think.
Right. Okay. And even like sometimes if someone has ideas that they're passionate about, maybe their ideas are 10, but their ability to communicate it is like a 2, mm-hmm. right? So you're saying there's power in being connected to your own emotions, understanding someone else's emotions who's sitting in front of you, and how to vibe with them or how to connect with them.
Yeah. That true connection. You know, when you're having a conversation with someone, you might be on a date, you have a conversation with someone and like an hour goes, it feels like it was 5 minutes.
Yeah.
That's the goal. Like if you can connect with someone on that level, that's where the magic is.
Wow. Yeah.
That's where the magic is.
Yeah. And how long have you been with your partner for?
2 years and a bit. Yeah. 2 years. Fuck yeah. I forgot.
And how you finding it like with her, meeting you and learning that you're an entrepreneur, you're always on the go.
Yeah. It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best thing ever. And it took me a while because I was single largely. There'll be some people that, yeah. largely single for about 8 years.
Yeah.
7, 8 years.
Okay.
And I, you know, built my life around every moment of every day, structured around my needs and what suits me and being free and being, you know, ambitious and this man on a mission, no one can stop me. And then like, as I said, I just turned 30 and like moving into that next stage of life where it's like serious relationship, you're with one person, family on the cards in the next couple of years. Like that was very scary for me moving into that. I and then we've talked about that. Like I didn't fucking realize what I was getting into.
Yeah.
Really. Like I didn't realize what a proper adult mature relationship was. Cause I'd never been in a proper adult mature. I'd been in, you know, relationships and flings and stuff, but like nothing serious. And like, I honestly, you felt like my body was like scared. Like it was like, fuck man. Like this is, it's just so much different to what I didn't really think about it too much. I followed fucking, it felt so right. And we went for it. And then like we started living together from pretty much straight away, a couple months in. And once I got over that and it was like, I've realized, hey, I had to, you know, that past life had to die in a little bit.
Right.
And once I accepted that, it was a little bit scary, but like, this is so much better.
Yeah.
Man, like this is so, like, you look at Andrew Schultz as an example as well. Like, all his biggest success has come, like, since he's found, like, that person for him. And, like, you're with the right person. I used to think, like, being with someone's going to take away from me and it's going to, no, they add to you, man. Like, once you have that connection, or if for the guys that it might be, like, late 20s or, you know, early 30s, moving into that next stage of life can be really scary. But I feel like once you see it for what it really is, I feel like it's really exciting. And if you asked me, like, a little while ago, I would have still been a little bit, like, afraid of that, but I truly think it's the best thing ever.
I agree with you, man. You know, and, like, when I was with Andrew Schultz, he was talking about his wife and just how much he loves her, and how the best part of his life has been able to just share with her.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, we were having this mad DNM moment where he's like, yeah, being with the woman that he loves, being married, it's just, he's just like, I'm just so excited to share everything with them. And I was like, what do you mean by sharing? He's like, just everything, like anything that comes up for me, being able to share it and feel safe and feel like that person gets it and they vibe with it. He's like, that's fire.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking, you know, with Ellie and my relationship, like, we have such an admiration for each other. And there's been different ebbs and flows of our relationship where it's all been good. And I think the beauty of that is we've always had each other's back. We've always been excited for whatever's happening, and always just been very present with that person. Mm. And I think, you know, finding that special someone, it's been, for me, it's been game changing. And I think a lot of my success has come from Ellie just telling me to go all in. Like, I'll share with her. I'm like, oh, I'm scared. This could happen. That could happen. What if this doesn't work? What if we can't pay the bills? And she's like, what if it does, you know, like, what if it works? And I think having that person in your corner to push you, to have your back, to share with you, it, you know, makes life a bit different. And life feels different.
Yeah. And for a lot of guys as well, their motivation to be successful is to get girls.
Yeah.
Like, they're fucking lying. Like, if they say that, a lot of it. And like, if you find that person and then that drive, like, is no longer there, but like the excitement of building a life with someone,
yeah,
that is such a better motivation than just, you know,
yeah,
like building a life to someone. Once you start like making decisions and plans, and like even things like we're doing heaps of rentals at our house, and our house is like fucking turning into like this place that we absolutely love and adore. And like doing that with someone is fucking, it's like you get this whole other business. Like, it's like you're building a business with all this person. Yeah. It's fucking sick, man.
Yeah. Building a life with someone is special because it's not always about you, but it's about sharing everything about you with someone who respects and admires that, and they do it vice versa. But like, yeah, for me, man, my driver is like, how can we build a rad life for me, my kids, and my partner, Ellie, and something that we're proud of.
Because you're not just thinking about yourself anymore. It's also, kids one day. And
dude, wait
and
till you have kids, man.
You have kids?
I got two kids. I got a three-year-old Harlow
and
a nine-month-old Joey.
Yeah.
So I got a boy and a girl. And I had them in the midst of growing the company. So interestingly enough, I thought I was working hard. And then I had Harlow, you know, my daughter. And as soon as I held her in my arms, I was like, oh, like this is a different feeling. Cause when you're with your partner, you're like, I want to do good and I want to look after them. I want to create beautiful moments with them and all the rest of it. When you have a child, you're like, oh, like I am bound to this person, like in every circumstance. And I basically am their world creator. Like I'm creating the world that they grow up in. I get to choose where they go to school, all the rest of it. It's just a stark responsibility of like, I'm responsible for the first like 18 years of this human being's life. But then that shifted my shit into a gear I didn't know I had.
Yeah. I was going to say, did it level you up in all assets, like in all aspects of life, including business?
Yeah.
Like in a weird way, it took away time, but you could just like.
Yeah. I felt less selfish because like I could work longer hours, work harder, do things I hated a lot easier because I was like, I'm doing this because I love them.
Mm.
So because I found it easier to do the harder things because I had so much love and passion to provide for that person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's exciting. I was at one of my best mate's kids' first birthdays on the weekend. So yeah, I've got plenty of friends. So
yeah.
Get into that age.
It's special, man. People will tell you, oh, it's gonna be the worst or whatever. I think the self reflection required to become a parent is so world changing.
Mm. Yeah. I'm excited as well because like, as I said, I'm really into personal development and I just feel like I know my personal development in like different ways than like, cause even like I grew so much like when my partner moved in with me, like I was like, fuck, I didn't realize I had all these weaknesses, like all these things I needed to work on. So yeah, I'm excited for that. Like anything that, cause like sometimes you need to bite off more than you can chew and then that levels you up. Some people be like, oh yeah, like, you're like, at some time I'm like, your life will never outgrow you. I get that. But at a certain point I'm like, I'm just going to fucking do something big and like chill like hell until I can fucking handle it.
Love it, man. And I'm happy you found that special someone, dude.
Yeah,
that's
cool.
Really cool.
It's cool, man.
All right, brother. Well, what have you got going on now and what do you want to put a spotlight on?
Yeah, before we wrap up. Fuck, I've got too much going on, to be honest with you. And that's something I've realized as well. This year is kind of be about building and scaling. Next year, I want to simplify. I guess the two main things, apart from my econ brands, is the podcast that you were on maybe a few months ago, Life, Money and Love. That's doing really well, having some awesome guests. So I want to take that to the next level in terms of guests. We've had some sick people come on. We want to do some stuff with our studio. We don't have quite as much space as you guys, but yeah, we want to,
we'll put a link in chat,
play around with that. And then just like I said when we were doing that little preamble, like I shifted my econ mentoring from helping people scale businesses because it was kind of a little bit less rewarding and focus on the transformations, helping people that, you know, might not be quite be there, have always had this dream to start a business, help them do that and execute and get to a certain extent and change lives, bro. That's so much more fun than being like, okay, how do we go from a million to 3 million? It's right. Just not as fun. So that's Viral Brand Builder. And then something I'm really excited about next year is a brand that I've been working on with my partner for a couple of years, like a fashion label. So
wow, man,
that'll be cool, man. That'll be out next year. That's called Dylan James.
Well, give us the links and we'll put them in the descriptors.
We'll do. Appreciate you, man.
I always appreciate having you on, man. We'll have to get you back.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate you, dude.